With stations all over the U.S., North America, Puerto Rico, Guam, and by satellite, we are Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Connie Willis. Have a very special guest in, our feature guest tonight. I'm very excited to bring this to you because I saw this man on, I just happened to be going through the internet. Excuse me, still getting over this flu. But I was going through the internet and I saw something on telepathy. And I went, oh, great, because the Bigfooting side of things is mind speak, right? With UFOs and aliens, telepathy. You're constantly hearing about that here in our world. So when I saw telepathy, and I saw, I think it might have been with psychology.com, psychologytoday.com that I saw this. It was an article, I think, in like 2014. And I went, oh, excellent. And so I thought, who is it that I can talk to that's a neuroscientist that's going to talk about telepathy and that it was real and they had some sort of evidence of it? So I started looking into it and I looked deeper into the man, and the man's name is Dr. Eric Hasseltine. And I pulled up a couple of videos. He did some TED Talks, and it was about 10 seconds or less, 10 seconds or less that I hit that video. And a lot of these neuroscientists, you know, E equals MC squared. All right, I get it. And that's cool. I want to hear that kind of stuff. But about, I would say more like 4 to 5 seconds, honestly, this guy starts talking on the video. I fell in love. Absolutely fell in love. Personality, character, out the yin yang. I mean, this guy had it going on. I was like, oh my gosh, he is this very intelligent guy, but he's also a normal, down to earth, funny, just right there with it. You know, it was very fun to watch. I said, oh, I gotta get this guy. Now I looked into him a little further and get this. Okay, he's done a lot of really cool things. He's been on a lot of really cool shows. And I'm going to let him tell you all that. Because even more important, what you and I think, at least, I think, he served as executive vice president in charge of research and development for the Walt Disney Company, Imagineer. Okay. Also, director of research at the NSA. Uh-huh. And associate director of national intelligence in charge of science and technology for the U.S. intelligence community. I find it interesting that he does this really cool stuff at Disney. Now, I was in Orlando for maybe 8 years or so in Winter Park area. And so, and it was in radio. And one of our affiliates out there right now, WDBO. Hey, everybody. But what was interesting about that is doing radio and television, you got to do a lot of, I would audition for Disney, or I'd do voice work for Disney or some shows for them. And I got to go out on their cruise line, the very beginning of their cruises. Now, those of you that love to do cruises, go on cruises, and you say, I don't want to take my kids, the Disney cruise is the one you want to take, because you can take your kids and never see them. And you take the 7-day one and you never see your kids. And then you think, well, I don't want to be around, you know, I'm an adult, I don't want to be around that. Yes, you do, because they have really cool things for adults to visually see and audibly hear that are just so far advanced, it freaks you out as an adult. So I'm thinking, this guy, to be in that position, he's using his brain to figure out some of these cool things that we all see and go, wow. At least I think we're going to talk to him about that tonight. But if he's doing cutting edge stuff like that, and then he's working with the NSA, what's the deal? So let's bring on Dr. Eric Hasseltine. Welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Connie, it's great to be here. I worry that I can only disappoint after that great intro.
You better not, man. The pressure's on. So tell me, so everybody else knows some of the other things about you. I know you've been all over the place. Tell us all about some of the things in your background that I didn't mention.
Well, I got my PhD in neuroscience studying snakes. I looked at the brains of pythons and rattlesnakes to study their infrared sensation. They can, quote, see in the dark, and that's how they find their prey. And that was a lot of fun. Then I went and did a postdoc in neuroanatomy at a medical school. taught medical students, neuroanatomy was just probably the scariest year of my life. You know what they call the person who graduates last in their medical school?
No.
Doctor.
Oh, yes, you're right.
Half of them are below average, and when you teach them, it really is sobering. Now, I say that being married to a doctor, and my sister's a doctor, and my niece is a doctor. But anyhow, so I did that. Then I went off and worked in aerospace for about 13 years, doing what eventually became called virtual reality. In those days, we called it flight simulation. But all the technologies in virtual reality and augmented reality really started with military training and simulation. And so it was easy for me then to move on to Disney, where I worked on their first virtual reality ride starting in 92. And I designed the head-mounted display for the Aladdin Magic Carpet ride, which we opened in 94 and just closed this year. You can imagine that. It was around for a long time. What happened in 9/11 is I had never served in the military and felt I ought to do something. And so General Hayden, who ran NSA at the time and later CIA, asked me if I would switch jobs running research at Disney to running research at NSA. And I did that. And then when they created this new organization to oversee the whole intelligence community, I was the first CTO of the intelligence world. And I did that for a few years. And now I'm back working at Disney, designing toys and doing other fun stuff.
Oh, my. Oh, my goodness. Just love hearing all this stuff. And it's all across the board. Like, I had a game that went that I created, and it went on to Toys R Us. And I always try to come up with other ideas as well. So to hear you talking about toys and this and that, I mean, it's all right there. I love it. But how do you go from Disney to NSA? From the fact that it's cutting edge technology and you're dealing with virtual reality stuff. So, I mean, how does that go from there to NSA? I don't understand.
Well, when you're running an R&D organization, it really doesn't matter where you are. The issues are the same. Innovation is really about changing human behavior. If you want to get something new in people's hands, that's the easy part, is inventing something awesome. The hard part is getting the whole food chain to change their behavior, from people who have to design it, build it, sell it, buy it, operate it, maintain it. And that's where my experience in neuroscience and human behavior came in that very early on I realized that innovation and science and technology are really all about people, getting the right people to do it, and then getting that technology into the hands of customers. It's all about understanding what really matters, and what really matters is getting inside people's heads and helping them change their behavior. And so the same is true at Disney. I was involved over the last few years in a new product we called Playmation, which was a really revolutionary product, and it did great. We won all kinds of awards, but it was so radically different than anything that had been done before. We didn't do well with it, and so we took stock of what we learned, and we came up with a new system. It's really augmented reality. It's the top-selling augmented reality headset in the world, but we don't call it that. We call it a lightsaber. Because what we understood is to get people to adopt something new, you have to make it look like something old they understand. And that same philosophy, believe it or not, works in the intelligence and military world, that especially when lives are at stake and it's life or death on the battlefield, commanders and soldiers are slow to change things they know work. So you have to get inside their head, figure out what's familiar to them, what they feel comfortable with, and make your thing look like their thing. So
familiar, something familiar.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I wrote the cover article for Psychology Today that's out on the newsstands now, and I talk about that, that if you want to improve your memory and your cognition and the way you explain things to people, take something that's unfamiliar to them and transpose it into something that's familiar. And, you know, an example of that is I was just talking to my wife, who's a physician, about quantum mechanics and neuroscience and how they're now combining. And I was explaining about these quantum principles and She's very, very bright, and I finally found a way to get across the idea of superposition by saying, you know, it's like the blind man and the elephant, right? To one blind man, it feels like a rope, that's the tail. To another, it feels like a tree trunk, that's the leg, and so forth. And that's the way quantum particles are. They behave differently depending on how you look at them.
It's all about association, right?
Right. So getting back to how did I move to NSA and why my skills from Disney were transferable, it's really the core foundation of it all is people, and those are the same wherever you go.
But aren't you at that point, are you in a situation where, you know, I've always heard that you guys are 20 years ahead of us, and what we see now, you guys did 20 years ago.
You guys, meaning you NSA or you Disney?
Well, you tell me, is it both? Because I'm definitely sure of that with military, but is Disney the same?
Yes. In fact, one of the techniques we use to invent new rides is something we call the time machine. And a time machine is, you imagine what you would want technology to do 10 years from now, and you spend whatever it takes to fake it or do it brute force. Maybe you buy a supercomputer or something like that that will be a cell phone in 10 years. And so you go out into the future with what you know is going to happen with the development of technology. You figure out what the killer apps are on that, and then you figure out which pieces of that you can use. You know, for example, 20 years ago, we saw that handheld devices were going to be big. So I went to Sharp in Japan, gave them a ton of money, and said, essentially build me what turned out to be very close to an iPhone. We're talking the mid-90s. And we deployed it in Animal Kingdom to do all kinds of things, in-queue entertainment, reservations. But you know what the killer app was? It was a text message saying, Mickey Mouse is signing autographs over by the castle right now. Everyone wants to go and get Mickey Mouse's autograph. So it turned out that by zipping into the future to do things that were theoretically possible but wildly impractical cost-wise, we discovered things in the present we could do now that would be very compelling. And so in that sense, Disney really is 20 years ahead because that's how we imagine the future. There's an old saying there, the best way to predict the future is to invent it.
Well, you know, remember when pagers were the big deal and everybody had a little pager, a colored pager, you get your favorite colored pager and you put it on your belt or your belt loop. Yeah, those were the times everybody wore belts. but I remember it was just about your phone number. However, we had all figured out, well, if you push these certain letter or numbers and then you turn it upside down, it says, I love you or hello or goodbye and tell little jokes. So that's kind of. You know, then later on, we're all texting like crazy, but we were really texting back then even.
We were. And but I think that it's a very interesting thing when we imagine the future, we do it with the building blocks of our past. So if we haven't experiencing something, we can't imagine it. I tell people when I give speeches on innovation to close their eyes and imagine a color they've never seen before. And
they can't do it. Yeah.
It's the way your brain works. But if you go out there and start doing stuff, roughly in a particular direction, you're going to stumble on things that you would never have imagined. But once you see them, you can recognize them as important. And that's really how you invent the future. You kind of stumble into it.
Well, when you're, I'm thinking of when the guy first invented potato chips, I think there was a mistake and that happened. And some of these things are mistakes that happen. But being at Disney and coming up with new things, it just seems like it'd be a whole lot more fun than being with the NSA, and maybe it's more of weaponry or?
Well, NSA is about intelligence gathering in foreign settings.
Okay.
So it's a foreign intelligence service, and so technology is very important, making and breaking codes and collecting intelligence. And I would say that in some ways it was more fun. Because we had tremendous resources. We had the best talent in the world for what we did, like mathematicians. And the mission was really important. In those days, it was about Al-Qaeda, the war on terror, and so forth, and preventing the next 9/11. And so there was a sense of importance. And I focused particularly on the roadside bomb problem in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I spent a lot of time in Iraq and Afghanistan traveling up and down the roads where people were getting killed to understand the problem. And probably the most satisfying thing I've ever done in my life is to put a dent in that problem. Of course, we didn't stop it completely, but we did cut down on the casualties. And I wouldn't necessarily call that fun, but in terms of psychic income, I can't imagine anything, more rewarding.
Rewarding, absolutely. So how did you make a difference with that?
Yeah, well, you see, now I can't really talk about that.
So it was a good question. It was a good question.
Yeah, it was a good question. I'll just say that we did, and it was technology, and I was very proud of my team that did that. And, the reason I went to Iraq and immersed myself in the battlefield is something that happened to Disney a few years earlier. When you get promoted to VP or higher at Disney, they put you together with a bunch of newly minted VPs and they fly you around the empire. And one of the things you do is you become a walk-around character. And I was Brer Bear down at Walt Disney World, and I had a script. And my script was to find daddies who looked kind of uptight or military or police with a couple little girls, grab them and dance with them. And invariably, the little girls would squeal with delight. I made a memory forever for that family. And I realized that I never really understood the entertainment business till I became an entertainer. You can read about it, you can, and so when we were at war, global war on terror and war in Iraq, I realized we're NSA is a combat support agency, and we were in two combats. So I said, I have to get out there. And so I was reproducing my Brer Bear experience. I know it sounds kind of bizarre, but it made a big difference.
No, I can understand that. I can relate to that as well, being in the entertainment world. But I remember when I lived in Orlando, it was always everything was always about Disney. And I remember the stories of I think it was Walt that had said, "Hey, everybody's got to kind of go do every job so that they'll know where everybody's seeing what their perception is and how to make it better and how to relate to everybody across the board." I always thought that was really good. I thought that was genius. I mean, it's so nice that way because then everybody can relate with each other too and realize what's going on and really learn from everybody else's perspective. You're listening to Coast AM. This is Connie Willis, and we're talking with Dr. Eric Hasseltine. More to come, the brain guy. It's another very interesting show here on Coast to Coast AM, the real theater of the mind. We are talking with Dr. Hasseltine, Eric Hasseltine, and he is a neuroscientist among many other things. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about that really touched me at first, obviously, was the telepathy. I know this was written in like 2014, but tell me about telepathy. I'm really interested because I love the I'm going back to the alien and telepathy stories that you hear all the time from abductees, and also the Bigfooters out there that talk about mind speak. So tell me scientifically what you guys know about telepathy and if it's real.
Well, I think if you ask the question, are some people able to really understand what's going on in the mind or heart of another? The answer is yes. And we're just now starting to understand the science of how that might happen in so-called normal science. So I kind of break it into three buckets. There's normal science, people can kind of get their arms around. There's things kind of in the middle, and I would put the quantum neuroscience in that realm. And then there's the paranormal. My own interests have been in the first two because there's an enormous amount of really cool stuff going on there. Let me give you some examples. We all have this phenomenon called implicit learning, where we learn without knowing that we're learning. And I'll give you an example of that. As I mentioned, I used to go up and down Route Irish from Baghdad Airport to the Green Zone. And one day, my driver, who was a corporal, slammed on the brakes, turned around, and went back in the other direction. And I said, "Corporal, why'd you do that?" And he said, "I don't know, but I knew I had to do it." And he'd had two tours of duty. And then later, after he calmed down, he said, "You know what? I'll tell you why. Because remember that field we used to go by every morning where there are kids kicking a ball around? There were no kids there. And I think that's because the moms know there's going to be a roadside bomb, and they kept their kids away. And my body knew that. My gut knew that. My brain didn't. And my body controlled my foot and turned the car around. So that's a kind of implicit learning where on his, what we mean is he hadn't explicitly associated a lack of kids playing with a threat of a bomb, but some primitive unconscious part of his brain did. And so implicit learning is one mechanism whereby we absorb all of this tremendous amount of information without being aware of it. And it's partly where intuition comes from. And it's partly where when we look at someone, we can sense whether they're telling the truth or not, how they're feeling, and so forth, because we've learned to associate a whole raft of sensory stimuli, the way they're postured, their facial expression, their tone of voice, and possibly even chemical signals. It used to be that we thought that only lower animals could smell fear and things like that. But it's now turning out that through pheromones, humans send chemical signals one to the other that we do interpret not at a conscious level, but at an emotional feeling level. So those are two phenomena, implicit learning. Maybe to give you a more concrete example of implicit learning, Connie, if you were in your studio right now and you looked around, and you listeners at home, look at wherever you are, look at every single surface and imagine what it would feel like if you put your tongue on it.
Ugh.
Okay? You could do it. There's not a single thing you're looking at that you don't actually have a pretty good idea what it would feel like, maybe even taste like if you licked it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not recommending you try this at home. I'm just saying this is a thought experiment, what Einstein called a Gedanken. And the question is, how do you know all that? And the answer is, as a baby, you put everything in your mouth. You know, how many moms say, don't put that in your mouth. Babies do that. And so they're storing up all those memories that are there to be used later without the baby consciously being aware. I mean, none of us quite remember learning language, but we did. That's another example of implicit learning. So because there's nothing more important in our life than other people, our brains consciously and unconsciously pay tremendous attention to other people and figuring out their motivations and predicting their behavior. So these are some kind of cognitive neuroscience ideas about how reading another person happens. Another one, I'll just tell a quick story. When I was at the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, I was very interested in doing interrogations that were not coercive. And I won't get into all the reasons for that, but I was very against coercion and torture and those sort of things. So I hired a bunch of professors at Harvard and places like that to look at what we knew about things like deception detection. And I learned something really interesting. An interrogator at one of the three-letter agencies told me, and I said, can you detect a lie in a prisoner or a detainee? And he says, no, not by looking at them. But when I want to do an interrogation, I don't do it. I have one of my good case officers do it, and I watch him. And his reaction tells me whether the detainee is lying. Because humans are like tuning forks. We have these things called mirror neurons, where when someone is having an emotion, we have a sympathetic kind of vibration inside of us that helps us read that other person's emotion by actually giving us the same emotion. And so he was watching the interrogator kind of resonate, if you will. And the interesting thing was he told me that the interrogators often didn't know they were doing it. It was all unconscious. So these are examples of things that we learn, and we think of them perhaps as telepathy or extrasensory perception because we're not consciously aware of how it is we know what we know. But like I say, cognitive neuroscience is now starting to understand how these things happen.
Well, when I think of telepathy, I'm thinking we are communicating back and forth, words, sentences, messages, direct, and a conversation is happening. Mm-hmm. Not just I'm reading you and I think maybe you're hungry for a popsicle or, you know, whatever. No, we're getting we're getting conversation back and forth. We're having a conversation. So has that, have you learned anything about that?
Well, I would say that it kind of fits in the same category that, like anyone who's been married a long time or grown up with someone can finish someone else's sentences, whole sentences, maybe whole paragraphs. It's because we create a model of that person in our mind. And here's the thing about perception of any kind. It's not a passive phenomena. You know, our eyes are not cameras. Our ears are not microphones. We create that which we perceive. In other words, we don't faithfully reproduce what's out there. Our brain creates it on the fly. And that's what a lot of optical illusions are about, where you see contours that aren't there, colors that aren't there, motion that isn't there. All of those are examples of how perception is really a very motor active thing. And so when it talks about, there's a part of the brain that we call theory of mind. It's that part of our brain that projects the other person into us so that we can understand them. And part of that, we do anticipate from lots of experience and our deep understanding of them, literally what they're going to say in a particular moment. So people I'm very close to, I can just watch them, and I do know what they're thinking, almost word for word. I wouldn't necessarily say it's telepathy, but in truth, I really don't know what it is. I know it's there.
You dealt with, when you were doing the military stuff, you're familiar with remote viewing, right? Mm-hmm. The real remote viewers from Project Stargate.
Right.
Okay, I'm not sure how much you know about it, but do you know the actual phases? Because there's a phase called phase 7 they call P7. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I actually didn't get much into that.
Oh, Mr. Brain Guy, you have to.
Well,
you'd love it.
I did. See, but, you know, in the military we have this thing we call a target-rich environment where there's so many things you could go after. What do you prioritize?
Sure.
And while I was there, the issues about brain and perception that I was targeting were, because it was so important in the global war on terror, was interrogation and how to get information in a humane and reasonable way, because we needed it. I mean, and so that was really my focus. It wasn't so much that it wasn't important what you're talking about. It's just that other things were more pressing at the moment. So
sure, no, I get that.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is, even within either normal science or some of the things that are kind of on the fringes of normal science, there's so much that we don't know, and it's so exciting that, you know, the mysteries, what we know about the brain and perception is 1/10 of 1/10 of 1% of what there is to know.
Yeah. You're exactly right. I love to hear that. And what we don't know, we don't even know what we don't know, right?
We don't know what we don't know. I don't know if you've heard of Marvin Minsky. He was the father of artificial intelligence. I knew him well, and I said, Marvin, are humans either individually or collectively smart enough to ever comprehend nature in its entirety? And he looked at me and he said, no, of course not. My cat over there is the smartest cat I've ever seen or heard of, but I'll never teach it French. By which, you know, by analogy there, you know, us understanding the depth of nature is like a cat talking French.
Hey, I'm just thinking of Pepe Le Pew, but I don't even think Pepe was, I think it was a skunk, right?
He's a skunk who kept presenting as a cat in order to be loved.
He was French.
He was French.
He was French. At least that's where I got that. So just to go back to that P7 I was telling you about, that's basically where when you're doing a remote viewing session, you get something called a P7, phase 7. And what it is it's basically like almost telepathy from the universe. You get a phrase or you get words or a song, something is given to you, and you actually get that in your head. And so I didn't know if you got to study in that area or not. Now, I got to throw this out at you before I move on to another question that I want to ask you about another subject. And that is, and I'm going to invite you to something. You can do it or not. It's up to you. But I got to tell you, I've experienced what people call mind speak, which is basically telepathy in the Bigfoot world. I got to go back to that because I've experienced it before. I had a complete conversation with something, just like everybody, you know, a whole, not everybody, but a whole lot of people have said before me and have told me, you know, this can happen, this can happen. I've spoken to them, I've spoken to them. I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. Well, you know, I went out for my first time and it happened to me. I never thought that was going to happen the first time because people go out 20 years and never have anything happen. So I never expected anything like that. But it was this full-fledged conversation. And you don't know it at the time. It's so innate. It's almost as though somebody flicked on a switch. We had a conversation. They flicked it back off. And one of the things that the father of remote viewing, Ingo Swann, had said that he believed we were dummied down so from the telepathy, so we could not communicate and nobody would know the answers. Now, I'm just giving you some really quick information on this kind of thing, but I got to tell you, I experienced that myself, and it's like, whoa, it's so cool, but it's innate. It's so natural, you don't even notice it until later you think about it. So I'd like to ask you in the future, if at one point you'll go out in the woods with me and other people that know where these things are in a hot spot, and we just hang out by the fire and see if you don't have a conversation. Would you be open to that?
Oh, I'm open to anything. I mean,
excellent.
I'll tell you one thing. You mentioned my TED Talks. One of the things is I look at the history of revolutionary breakthroughs, and they're all like this, that most of them, almost all of them, seem really bizarre and out there when they're first brought up.
Yes,
and then
yes.
Later they become received wisdom. You know, I have a very open mind, and there's one thing I want to come back to, the telepathy and that sort of thing, and remote viewing. I thought a lot about this. I've worked with the police, and I've worked with intelligence agencies, and there are people who are very hard-nosed, practical, empirical, Myers-Briggs S types, you know, show me type people. They don't want to believe anything until I see the data. And I've seen some of them really embrace the idea of things like remote viewing or a psychic who can tell the police where a body has been dumped under a bridge and that sort of thing. And I thought, well, suppose for a moment that it's real. What could be happening there in more of the so-called mainstream science? And one of the things that we know about the human brain is that there are some people who have extraordinary abilities. You think about the Rain Man type of character with autistic savant, and then there are people with acquired savant. They dive into a pool, they get a concussion, and all of a sudden they're a genius musician or a genius artist or, you know, genius mathematician. This happens. There are documented cases of this that suggest that all of us have a genius inside of us, but that for various reasons, it doesn't come out. And so I believe that it is possible, if you look at the unbelievable heights of what the human brain is capable of, and then you put that aside and you look at what's happening with AI right now and big data analytics, we can see trends in human behavior from big data. For example, did you know that a few days after a prominent suicide, the number of car accidents and plane accidents goes up because they're really mass suicides that people kind of do by suggestion because Robin Williams, you know, committed suicide, then people kind of get the idea they will too? Well, we
kind of like the full moon thing?
Well, yeah. So here's the point I'm trying to make is with big data and the kinds of things you hear about with machine learning and AI, we're starting to learn that there are these hidden emergent properties of the human condition that can come out, like the mask suicide problem. And I believe it's entirely possible that there are savant-like people who can just do that. They see the connections, they form the patterns, and conscious or unconscious, they may know that a particular, say, kind of killer who's gonna kill a certain victim is gonna put them in a particular place, because that's a pattern of human behavior that repeats over and over again. That's why, you know, at Quantico, they have the behavioral science unit to look at repeating patterns like that. So one of the ideas I have about things like remote viewing and the kinds of things you're talking about is that there are some people who will have savant-like abilities that focus in that direction. And then all of us, I think, have some of that that's buried deep that also can come into play. So that is kind of, I think, a you know, more of a mainstream approach to how this could happen. But, you know, that in of itself, if it's true, I think is worth investigating and is very interesting.
I like to hear that. You know, that's what I like, that you're open to that, because we need people like you that have really studied this stuff in a scientific way, but is open to what else is out there, which may be a whole nother science, which is, you know, quantum. And I did notice You said science, quantum, and paranormal, where I would probably maybe put paranormal into quantum. Let me say this about something else you said. When a skeptic, non-believer, or a debater of these things, let's just say I'm going to stick to Bigfoot because I can relate to that one big time in this scenario I'm going to tell you. But if someone said to me, "Hey, Connie, okay, you got this camera, and you're out there with a skeptic or a non-believer, and you see Bigfoot, and you got a camera with you. Here's what I would do. If I had a chance to get the shot, best shot of Bigfoot, better than Patterson-Gimlin, or I can get a shot of that non-believer skeptic seeing it, I'd rather get, because I already know Bigfoot's real, so I can get that shot at another time. I want a picture of that skeptic and that non-believer seeing it for the first time and freaking out and showing what they do when they actually see it for real. That's what I would do. You're listening to Coast AM. I'm Connie Willis, and we are talking with Dr. Eric Hasseltine. He is a neuroscientist as well as so many other neat things. And we're going to talk to him a little bit more about, well, why don't we go into the pineal gland? Let's talk about that next. Stay with us. Connie Willis here on Coast to Coast AM.